Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon. We have a phone number you can call if you want to be on the air to ask a Bible question or express a difference of opinion from the host. You're free to do that here. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Just want you to know that this Saturday night, we have in Southern California, a gathering that happens once a month in Buena Park, California. That's in Orange County. And we go through and I do an introduction and an overview of a different book of the Bible every month. This month, on Saturday night, this Saturday, we're going through the Gospel of John. If you're interested in joining us, go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That is if you don't already know where the meetings are. If you're a regular attender, never mind. Just show up. But if you don't know, you can go to thenarrowpath.com, look at the tab that says Announcements, and look at this Saturday's date, and you will find the time and the location and all that information. All right? Now, we've got our lines full, and I'm going to take this out of order a little bit because we have a caller from Austria, and when people call from overseas, I try to put them at the head of the line as much as possible. This is Fabian from Austria. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Well, I have a question. Could you explain the difference between soul and spirit? You know, not to understand, I have an Adventist background, however, I'm questioning some doctrines. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder, because the Bible, as far as I'm aware, is speaking about the spirit going to heaven, but never mentions the soul. Well, what's the exact difference? Could you explain that? Maybe.
Well, I might be able to. I might not, because the problem is the word soul is used in a variety of ways in the Bible, and sometimes it almost seems like it's equivalent to the spirit. Other times it seems to be distinguished from the spirit. So that's where we'd have to look case by case. In the Old Testament, the word for soul, the Hebrew word is nephesh. And nephesh is a word that's just used for any living creature, any sensate being. A human being is a nephesh. An animal is a nephesh too. I mean, when God breathed into man's nostrils, he made him a living nephesh. But he had already made the animals nepheshes. But in the Bible, it's usually translated a living soul. Although when it's applied to animals, it might be used in the word creature or something like that. So the word soul in the Old Testament normally means just a being, a sensate being. Although many times in the Psalms especially, David will speak about his soul, you know, bless the Lord, O my soul. Now he could, but then he clarifies, says all that is within me, bless his holy name. So he seems to be speaking about his inner part as his soul, even though the word soul in the Old Testament sometimes just refers to the whole person. But see, there we've got the nebulousness that makes this a difficult thing to answer. When you come to the New Testament, the word soul in the Greek is psuche, as you know, the word psychology comes from it. It's P-S-U-C-H-E in English characters, or you could say psyche, P-S-Y-C-H-E. But it has to do, in the Greek thought, the soul has to do with the intellect and the emotions and the will, what I might refer to as the mind, in contrast to the brain. The brain's a physical organ, but the mind is the conscious functioning of the brain. And so there's a sense in which the soul in the Greek, if the New Testament writers are meaning it in the way that the Greeks use the term, which is probable since they're using the same word that they got from the Greeks, probably speaking of the what we might call the mental and emotional functions, the non-physical aspect of our personhood. But then that begins to bleed over into the question of spirit. Well, do we have a spirit and a soul, or is the soul the same thing as the spirit? Now, you might like me to settle that question, but that's not the easiest thing either, because frankly, a lot of theologians are what they call trichotomists, which means they believe humans are three parts, body, soul, and spirit, so that the soul and spirit are different entities. And many Christians are dichotomists, which means they believe humans only have two parts, the physical and then the inward part, which can be called the soul or the spirit or the heart or the mind. In other words, the non-physical aspect of a person. And a dichotomist would say all these words are pretty much used interchangeably, spirit, soul, heart, and so forth, when it's used metaphorically that way. It's just talking about the inward part as opposed to the outward part of a person. In fact, Paul even sometimes just uses the expression the inner man. And Peter uses that expression too in talking about women, let their adornment not be the outward adorning of plaiting the hair and putting on gold and so forth, but he says let it be the inner man of the heart in 1 Peter chapter 3. So we have this inner man. Paul says, though the outward man is perishing, the inner man is being renewed day by day. If Paul means by the inner man that whole complex of the non-physical person, which can be called soul, spirit, mind, or heart, perhaps interchangeably, or is somehow a meshing of these different things, and each one has a slightly different meaning, this is never made clear in Scripture. And that is why, I don't know what the Jehovah's Witnesses think about this, but it's why they probably, and some other Christians certainly, would have differing ideas about this, and why it makes it so difficult to really answer it. I mean, a person could pick a choice, could take a choice of one of the ideas, but they wouldn't really, in my opinion, have a solid case over against other theories. So I think the most I could say, I'll tell you, my leaning is that there is some shade of difference between the soul and the spirit. But again, there are times when the terms soul and spirit seem to be overlapping domains, or maybe even used synonymously sometimes or interchangeably. But I will say the soul, I take the soul in the Greek sense of just the mind, the intellect, the emotions, the will, the mental functions. And the word spirit, perhaps, at least in some occurrences, seems like it may be referring to that spark of the image of God, of the divine that God put into us, and which basically comes alive when we're born again. And that would be perhaps different than, certainly different than the mind, and it might be distinguished from the soul. So I put a whole bunch of confusing things out there because I'm uncertain. I almost said because I'm confused, but I'm actually not confused. I don't get confused about things I don't have to be sure of. I'm uncertain about many things. Confusion happens when you've decided I can't stand to be uncertain. I have to make up my mind, and I don't know what the right answer is. I'm not in that state. I don't know for sure what the right answer is. But in my opinion, but I don't feel like I have to know. I don't feel like knowing the right answer to this will have any impact on my Christian life at all. If you're thinking as a Seventh-day Adventist, you know, from your upbringing, how they believe that when you die, you know, you there's no conscious part of you that remains conscious until the resurrection. And they believe in soul sleep. And I don't know if that's the issue you're wrestling with. But I would say the Bible does say there's something besides our body. We can be at home in our body, Paul used that expression, or absent from the body. So obviously we, who can be either at home in or absent from the body, we are something other than the body. Just like I must be something different than my house if I can be at home in it or away from it. Obviously I'm something other than it. And the same is true of our body. We are spiritual, non-physical entities that are also joined during life with a physical organism, and then at death separate from it, apparently. But as far as the difference between the soul and the spirit, as if we're talking about each of them in terms of the non-physical part of humanity, I don't know that we can make sure of any firm differences between the two. At least I can't.
All right. Thank you so much.
I wish I could help you more. I wish I knew more.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. God bless you. Bye now. All right. Let's see. Longest wait here has been from Ben in Garden Valley, California. Ben, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for all your work and everyone that supports you. And excited that you're coming to the area. We're going to come out of the mountains to come hear you speak.
Oh, going to draw you out of the woods, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
But my question is about the difference between the law of faith, as Paul refers to in Romans 3:27, and what some people, it seems, I've heard one teaching that's been going around our church with, or a lot of people, you know, they have different views on it. They believe, I've even heard, you know, we're not plugged into the law of faith to be able to manipulate it. And I know you've done a lot of lectures and stuff. I just don't know the biblical law of faith that Paul is referring to, and the difference between the one that, you know, that we can plug into supposedly to work our wonders or through God, which, you know, he's...
Well, okay, the law of faith, when Paul uses it in Romans 3, he's not using it the way... Oh, you've got your radio on, so it's, I'm hearing a few seconds ago. Okay, I'm going to put you on hold so I don't have to hear myself twice. The law of faith is viewed by the word of faith doctrine as something analogous to the laws of nature, or the law of gravity, for example. And they say there are laws of nature that govern the physical world, and we learn to live with them, sometimes to manipulate them, sometimes to counteract them, but we are aware of them, and we have to be aware of them, and in some respect relate to them. Now, they say just as there are laws of the physical world, there's laws of the spiritual world, the chief of which is the law of faith. Now, they say that just like the law of gravity is a force that apparently, you know, draws things to the center of solid objects, so the law of faith is a force also, that faith is a force. And that if we learn the laws of faith, just like if a scientist learns the laws of gravity or of motion or of aerodynamics or of something like that, then scientific things can be exploited. And same thing they say with the law of faith. They say the law of faith is if you believe it and you confess it and you don't allow the slightest doubt to come into your mind and you've got total confidence in it, then the universe will work for you. Now, they don't say the universe. They'd say God or faith will work for you. If you're dealing with some occult group or some occult book, like, let's say, The Secret, you know, the book The Secret, it teaches the exact same thing, only there's no God in it. It's the universe that does these things. The idea is that if you're confident and, you're sure and you have faith and positive thinking, and in The Secret, they'd say you're manifesting. You manifest the thing. That is, you make it happen by your confidence in it, sort of the power of positive thinking. And that's what the word of faith teaches, too, only they don't say the universe does it. They say, you know, God does it, or, you know, something more Christian-sounding. The problem is that it's not true. I mean, there's no such thing as the law of faith. The power behind our prayers and any power that may be in our faith is really the power of God himself. And it's not God is not a power that we manipulate like we can manipulate, say, electricity or nuclear power. He is a person who is a powerful person. So a child who has a strong father can count on his father, you know, to open the jar that the kid can't open for him, or to protect him from the bullies, or do something like that. I mean, he trusts in the power of his father. He doesn't see his father's power as sort of a nebulous kind of a energy that he has to learn the techniques to manipulate and to exploit. No, his father is somebody who cares about him and has the power to do things for him, and that a child comes to with his requests, that the father will come with his superior power to assist in something that the child knows he cannot do himself. Now, in other words, this is not dealing with a force like in the Star Wars force, you know, the force is with you, which is also kind of the same kind of idea as The Secret and some of these other occultic ideas, but and it kind of like the word of faith in a way. I mean, the word of faith certainly believes in God, but they actually believe the force of faith is above God himself, because Kenneth Hagin, for example, says that God himself uses the law of faith, that they say that God used the law of faith, and he had faith in his own words, and it's that faith that he had in his words that caused the universe to be created. That's all, you know, metaphysical mumbo-jumbo. There's nothing like that in the Bible. The Bible just speaks of God as someone who has the power to do what he wants to do and does it. And he happens to be our father and concerned about us so that we can ask him to intervene when there are things we can't do that need to be done, and we know he can. We don't simply tap into that power like plug it into a socket in the wall and now we have the energy to do whatever we want. Now, we're talking to a father here. We're talking to somebody who's got a will, someone who might say no, someone who doesn't always have the same priorities that we might have because he's wiser and better than we are. And for that reason, we can't make him do anything. And we should be glad that we can't, because anything we ask him to do that he chooses not to do is something that was a better idea than what we had. You know, he's smarter than we are. So the word of faith kind of ignores that fact. Of course, the word of faith doesn't teach that God's not a father. It's just they kind of ignore that when they talk about faith. Faith is like a power. Faith is like a law. And if they might quote Paul in Romans 3, where Paul says, you know, by what law? By the law of faith or the law of works. And he says, by the law of faith. Here, Paul is using the word law not in the sense of a natural law, like the law of gravity, and not in the sense of a regulation, like the law of the land. He's using the word law in the sense of a principle, like we might say the laws or the rules of logic. It's a principle. And he's saying a person is justified not by the laws, not by the principle of works, he said, but by the principle of faith. That is, salvation works on different principles than people think. Many people think that if they do enough good works, then they'll be saved. He says, no, it's not that way. If you have the right faith in the right person, that it's a different principle. It's a different, the law of faith, therefore, should probably be translated the principle of faith. And in which case, he's not talking about some kind of a abstract, metaphysical, cosmic law. He's just talking about, you know, on what principle? On what principle are we saved? We're not on the principle of salvation by works, but on the principle of salvation by faith. That's all Paul is actually saying when he uses the word law of faith there. So the word of faith people, they have made up a doctrine, then they go looking for words in the Bible that sound like they might say things that might fit that doctrine, and that's a verse they sometimes use, but that has actually nothing to do with its meaning, that Paul had in mind. Okay. I appreciate your call. I need to talk to another caller here in California, Craig from Temecula. Craig, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm a believer, and I like to collect answers for hard-to-answer questions from the Bible when I can't find them.
Uh-huh.
However, please bear with me. This one, my questions are from an unapologetic devil's advocate perspective.
Okay.
This is about the book of Judges. It's to me, the most awful book in the Bible. And in it are many stories, worse is the story of Samson. The whole story seems too stupid to be believable and too awful to consider Samson as a hero from God. He makes a vow of holiness, and he uniquely gets super strength right out of the comics from it, all the while breaking every aspect of his vow. He eats honey from a dead lion's carcass and kills men with a bone, making him biblically unclean and a murderer with no mention of rectification. His riddle is not even a real riddle, but something a dumb child with rhyming skills might imagine. The riddle wasn't enough to prove Samson was very dumb. Every one of his actions declare it. His story is in every children's book on Scripture, but the only thing he really did well was murder men. The worst and most unnecessary part that I cannot say I believe with a straight face is that Samson had tied around 300 foxes together by their tails, and it was lit them all on fire to burn down all the crops of the Philistines. How am I, as a believer, supposed to defend the inerrancy of the Bible with a story that dark and far-fetched? How could a God of love with infinite intelligence and creativity inspire such a dim-witted, dark, and gruesome story in life and think it would go well into a book that would later be considered God's holy word? When people ask me questions like this, I have no good answer, and with all the good things I and others have said about God, this story is embarrassing to even acknowledge as anything other than a mistake. So what gives?
Okay. Well, Judges is a rather dark book. There are a lot of bad things. I wouldn't call them, say, dumb things. I mean, things ancient people did and thought might seem dumb to us, partly because they're culturally so different. But yeah, Samson was not a hero in the sense of a virtuous man. As far as him taking a vow of holiness, he didn't really take one. His parents took it for him before he was born. An angel told his parents, you know, when you have this son, he's going to have to be a Nazirite from his birth. So they raised him under the terms of this vow, but he apparently never really owned it and didn't care that much about it. He was not a very godly man. Now, you say he was a murderer. Actually, in the context of the book of Judges, yeah, he was actually regarded more as a warrior. And sometimes the difference between a warrior's actions and a murderer's actions are not, there's not a great deal of difference, but there is a different context. All of the judges in the book of Judges were raised up and empowered by God in different ways. Samson muscularly, but others were empowered in other ways, to drive the invaders out of Israel. And most of them did so quite thoroughly. Samson did not succeed, but he worked at it. I mean, his career of fighting was in the vein of the other judges. Israel had been invaded and was under oppression from the Philistines, an outside invading force. And if he'd been a godlier man, like Gideon or some of the earlier judges, Samson might have succeeded in driving the Philistines out. Instead of, because he wasn't very godly, his victories were piecemeal. One of the stories is that he killed 1,000 people with the jawbone of an ass, and he tore the gates off a city and carried them up a hill and dropped them there, and he did all kinds of super strength kinds of things, and that was, at least as the Bible would suggest, that's because God had chosen him for a task. But it's not. You say you don't know why God would inspire such a stupid story. It's not that God inspired a stupid story. The story is a true story. I mean, some elements of it maybe we have to look at and say, well, is that entirely true? Is that hyperbole? But it's a story about a man who did some stupid things. And the Bible is not simply a book of stories about smart people. It's a book of stories about reality. And in reality, not many people are that smart. And most people do stupid things. Even the great heroes like David and Solomon end up being kind of dumb in some of their actions. Almost everyone does. Moses, and there's not very many people in the Old Testament that don't do something stupid, and Samson did more than his share. And that's because he wasn't really very devoted to God. He was born under the demands of an oath that he'd never really carried out. He defiled himself touching the carcass of a lion. A Jew should not do that. There's lots of things he did that a Jew should not do. He consorted with a prostitute. That's not a very godly thing to do either. And that's what eventually got him killed. But, you can't blame God for the character's behavior. Now, if we're looking at the Bible as a collection of moral tales that are essentially fiction and myths that are supposed to teach us moral stories and show us good heroes, then, of course, the book of Judges would really raise questions about that. But the Bible is not really a book about myths at all. It's a book about real people who actually do some really stupid things, and it does not sugarcoat it. The Bible does not ever make the bad guys look better, and in many cases, it even makes the good guys look as bad as some of their actions would require. So, the Bible's not painting some kind of mythic hero like the Greek gods or something like that. Now, you mentioned that, he has his super strength like right out of the comic books. The truth is, the Superman in the comic books probably got it more from him rather than him getting it from them. I don't think the writer of Judges had ever read any comic books and had never heard of, modern superheroes. So I think a man having super strength, we consider it like Superman or, the Hulk or something like that. And yet, that's because those are made up stories about men or fake men who would have incredible strength. But Samson didn't fly through the air or have X-ray vision or anything like that. He just did great feats of strength. Now, most societies have in their history some heroes who did really amazing feats. I mean, whether it's Ulysses or some of the Roman heroes or Greek heroes or whatever. And that's because there probably are men who have done far more feats of strength and battle victories than very many other people would do, and they do become well known. Samson obviously was one of those people. He's not described as being like Superman, who nothing could kill him. A woman could cut his hair, and then he'd be as weak as any other man. And so, I don't see the flaws in the story. I see the flaws in the man. I don't see it as a problem that the Bible tells this story. Now, as far as him taking 300 foxes and tying torches to their tails, there are some who feel that whoever is the source of that story may have used a little hyperbole, and maybe it wasn't really 300, though we don't know that it wasn't. The word fox in the Hebrew is the same word for jackal, and they have both of them in in Palestine even today, jackals and foxes. Foxes are solitary and hard to find and hard to hunt down. Jackals run in packs, and a person could presumably, with the right kind of trap, trap a bunch of them. Now, I don't know that anyone has ever trapped 300 of them, but the Bible says that he caught 300. It doesn't say he did it overnight. Maybe he was collecting them. Maybe he had a big, maybe he was collecting jackals in a big pit until he could get the right number. Who knows? Might have taken him a year or more. I don't know. But what one thing I can say, nothing that is technically impossible is reported. Just strange things that are very, you know, it would certainly in many cases would require some supernatural aid. But supernatural aid is in fact one of the features of the story. So I guess I don't have the same embarrassment as you do. There's lots of stories that are unpleasant and dark in the Bible, especially the book of Judges, but that's because it tells stories about people who did dark and stupid things. And so I guess that'd be my approach when I read a story like that. I hope that helps you a little bit, Craig. We can talk more some other time, but I have to take a break here. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We do have to take a break for about a minute, and we want you to know The Narrow Path is listener-supported. If you want to help us out, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. I'll be back in 30 seconds. We have another half hour coming up.
Tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone you know about the Bible radio show that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. And that's The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. When today's radio show is over, go to your social media and send a link to thenarrowpath.com where everyone can find free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And tell them to listen live right here on the radio. Thank you for sharing listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Our lines are full, but if you want to try to get in a little later, you can reach us at the number 844-484-5737. One announcement I want to make is that my wife and I are making a kind of a cross-country itinerary where I'll be speaking in a number of places. And we're starting out in California and going back to Indiana and then back. And we thought, well, I'm only really planning to speak a few places. 2 years ago, we made this same kind of a trip, and I spoke in like 26 places in 30 days on this trip. And we decided we don't want to be that busy. But there's a few places set up and enough to justify us making this trip. But I would say, though I'm not looking to have a lot of meetings, I don't mind meeting friends of the ministry along the way for coffee, for breakfast, for lunch, for dinner, or something like that, just to get to know some of the people. If you live somewhere along our route and you'd like us to be in touch with you, we might be able to see you. If you want to hold a little meeting in your home with some of your friends and have me do some Q&A or something, that we might be able to fit that in too. What you need to do is go to our Facebook page, or it's on the website too. Yeah, okay, it's on our website too, thenarrowpath.com. And there's a map showing all the cities, or a list of the cities we'll be passing through. If you live in or near one of those cities and you'd like to get in touch with us and see if we might connect somehow with you, this is during the month of August, then you might get in touch with me. You can write to me at steve@thenarrowpath.com. My wife is coordinating things, so if you write to me, I'll pass it on to her and she can get in touch with you and see if there's something we can do to connect. Say, hey, we'd love to get to know people out there. We're just regular folks. Just because I'm on the radio, don't make the mistake of thinking I'm a celebrity. I'm certainly not. I'm just a regular folk guy who I feel when I do this show, and I've felt this for 25 years doing this show every day, I just feel like I'm sitting in my living room with a bunch of friends talking about the Bible. That's exactly my mindset here every single day. And I am, in fact, in one of the rooms of my house doing this, but there's just not visible audience. There's just you people. And the people who I call in, who do call in and we talk to, it's like the people in my living room that we're talking to every day. And I enjoy it. And I wouldn't mind meeting many of you that I've never seen face to face, or some of you that I have. Okay, let's go to the phones again and talk to Bruce from Citrus Heights, California. Bruce, thanks for waiting.
Yeah, thank you. I'm calling about a guy that was a very active evangelistic Christian and then turned up come to Judaism. And two questions about how to approach him. One is, given that he has a 8-page of stuff that his rabbi gave him explaining how Christ wasn't the Messiah. So can I talk to him about how the New Testament explains the Old Testament is my broad question. Then I'll give you one of the issues, and you can kind of walk me through it so I can understand it.
Okay. You want to bring one of those up?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay.
The northern and southern kingdoms will be one again. And he cites Jeremiah 31, I'm guessing verse 1, and Ezekiel 37, I'm guessing the two sticks.
Mm-hmm.
So that didn't happen.
No, it didn't. Not in the way they expected. You're right. Yeah, Jesus did not do what the Jews thought the Messiah would do, which is why Orthodox Jews do not receive Jesus as their Messiah. They thought the Messiah would do certain things, and Jesus didn't do them. Now Christians have two different answers to this. They're not both right, but different opinions. There are some Christians who say, well, that's still going to happen. That what Jews have to understand is that part of the prophecies of the Messiah were fulfilled when he was here the first time, and the other part is delayed until his second coming. That's what's called the dispensational view, and therefore they would argue that the gathering of all the tribes together is going to happen. Be patient; it just hasn't happened yet. Jesus is going to fulfill the messianic prophecies in two stages: those that he fulfilled at his first coming, and the ones he'll fulfill at his second coming. So they'd say that removes that difficulty. Now the answer that most Christians throughout history gave, and which I would personally give, is that the fulfillment of those prophecies is spiritual. And by taking them in a physical sense, I think they are missing the point. Now, Paul, for example, and of course Jews don't accept Paul, but that's their problem, you know. He was a Jewish Pharisee, a Jewish scholar of his law, and he met Christ on the road, and he got filled with the Spirit, and God began to reveal things to him, and Jesus would appear to him, and he even was caught up in the heaven once. The Jews can deny this all they want to, although, of course, they have to have some reason to, they have to explain some reason why Paul changed. Why did Saul become the Apostle Paul if he didn't meet Jesus? They might have an answer, but to my mind, it's not going to be as good as the biblical answer. In any case, the Christian view, whether the Jews accept it or not, is that the things that the law says are spiritual, and that the prophecies, many of them were fulfilled spiritually. And Paul said in 2 Corinthians 3 that the Jews cannot see this. He's talking about Jews who are not believers. He himself, of course, is a believing Jew, but he's talking about the majority of Jews who don't believe in Christ. He says they don't see this. He says when they read their law, when they read the Torah, they have a veil over their mind, he said, and they can't see it. And that veil is taken away when they turn to Christ, Paul said. That's in 2 Corinthians 3. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul said that spiritual things have got to be spiritually discerned. He said the natural man cannot receive the things of the Spirit of God. We might even take the example of Nicodemus, who was a teacher of the Jews, a member of the Sanhedrin, a Pharisee, very much perhaps like some of the best of the Orthodox Jews today. He would certainly have been called an Orthodox Jew if he were living today. And Jesus said, you must be born again. Well, the man took him quite literally, physically. And Jesus said, no, I'm talking about being born of the Spirit here. Whatever's born of the flesh is flesh. Whatever's born of the Spirit is spirit. And so the danger is that many things Jesus said which are spiritual, not only Jews, but even some Christians, mistakenly, I think, take them to be physical things. Because Jesus, I mean, think of, for example, when Jesus said, you have to eat my flesh and drink my blood. Although in John 6, where he said that, he followed that up by saying, the words I'm speaking are spirit and they're life. In other words, he's not speaking about literal eating of flesh and blood. He's speaking spiritual things, not physical things. He said, the flesh profits nothing. It's the spirit that gives life. in that same conversation. But there are those who feel, oh, we should take that very literally. We have to eat his literal flesh and his literal blood. And, of course, those who are Eucharistic Christians believe, in many cases, that the bread and the wine actually become the body and blood of Jesus, which I don't agree with. But see, that's taking Jesus in a physical, literal sense when he was speaking spiritually. And I think people have made the same mistake with the prophets in the Old Testament. Many times they're speaking spiritually. In Malachi, for example, the very last prophecy in the Old Testament says that God's going to send Elijah the prophet before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. Now, Jews today, Orthodox Jews, believe Elijah the prophet's actually going to come because Malachi said so. But when the disciples asked Jesus, why do the rabbis say that Elijah's going to come? Jesus said, well, because, you know, he mentions Malachi's prophecy. He does come and restores all things. He says, but I tell you, if you can receive it, John the Baptist is Elijah, who was to come. So Jesus saw John as the fulfillment of the prophecy about Elijah, but John himself knew he was not the man Elijah, but he came in the spirit and power of Elijah. That's what the angel said to John's father. So this was not the literal coming of Elijah. It was a spiritual coming of Elijah in another person who came in the spirit and power of Elijah. Now, what I'm saying is that Jesus and the apostles, which the Jews, of course, today do not acknowledge their authority. So, I mean, we can tell them what they said, but the Jews can say, well, we don't accept that. Well, that's their business. They don't have to. People don't have to accept anything that anyone else says. But if they wonder, how does a Christian account for this? How do Christians account for the fact that Jesus didn't gather all the Jews together again? Well, the New Testament teaches that he did gather the children of God who were scattered abroad. It says that in John chapter 11. It's when Caiaphas said to the Sanhedrin, we need to kill Jesus. It's better for one man to die for the nation than that the whole nation perish. John, the writer, says, yeah, he didn't realize what he was saying. He was prophesying that Jesus would have to die for that nation. And not only for that nation, John says, but that the children of God that are scattered abroad might be gathered together into one. That is to say, you know, all the people of God who are scattered throughout the world, which includes Christian, Gentiles, and Jews. But you see, Isaiah said that God was going to gather Israel's children from the east and the west and the north and the south. Jesus said that many will come from the east and the west, north and south, sit down in the kingdom of God with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but the children of the kingdom, meaning the natural Jews who are, in fact, rejecting Christ, will be cast out. That Jesus is talking about Gentiles who believe coming in as the people from the north, south, east, and west. So there are spiritual fulfillments of these Old Testament passages, which Jesus and the apostles, taught, which the Orthodox Jews would not accept. And so that's going to be the issue there with them. You're not going to find the rabbi being impressed with this. I might mention that Michael Brown, Dr. Michael Brown, a Jewish believer and scholar, do you know who he is?
No.
Oh, well, he's a very famous Jewish scholar. He's written lots of books. He's written a very good set of four volumes. I think it's called, I think it might be called Christian Answers to Jewish Objections to Christianity or something like that. It's got a name like that. I've got the whole set, but I can't see it from where I'm sitting. And it's got, it has to do with answers to Jewish objections to Jesus or to Christianity. And he goes through scores and scores of the typical Jewish complaints about Christianity, about Jesus, and so forth, and the very objections. I doubt if he leaves any of them out, because he's quite the Jewish scholar. He spends a lot of his career debating rabbis. But he gives very good and answers to them. If somebody really wants to interact with Jews about it, I would recommend getting Dr. Michael Brown's books on that subject. But realize, too, that a Christian who says, well, I think I'll go into Judaism, He's not only leaving Christianity for another religion, he's leaving for a religion that is a man-made religion. Oh, by the way, the name of those books is called Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. That's the name of the set. There's four volumes. Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus by Dr. Michael Brown. A good set of books. But anyway, the Jewish religion today isn't even biblical Judaism. If somebody said, I just don't think Jesus is really the Messiah, but I do believe in Moses. I do believe God brought Israel out of Egypt and made a nation of them, made a covenant with them at Mount Sinai, and gave them Moses and the prophets. I just don't believe Jesus is the Messiah. Well, I mean, that's, to my mind, one option a person could take. But the problem is you can't go back now to observe Sinaitic Judaism. It doesn't exist. The religions founded by Moses had a tabernacle, a Levitical priesthood, animal sacrifices. That was the center of the whole thing. For 1,400 years, the center of the whole Jewish religion was these animal sacrifices later in the Temple of Solomon. And that doesn't exist anywhere. No modern Jew practices Judaism from the Bible. They practice Talmudism. Now, Talmudism is a man-made religion that was created by Jewish rabbis after the destruction of Jerusalem. When Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70, there's no more temple. So Judaism simply could not be practiced anymore, because Judaism is about the temple and sacrifices and priests. That's that. You read the Old Testament, that's what it's all about. And so Judaism, as it was in the Old Testament, simply does not exist and has not existed anywhere for 2,000 years. It doesn't exist now. So since I'm gonna go back to Judaism, good luck. Where are you going to find it? Well, there's a synagogue down the road here. Well, if they're Orthodox Jews, they're probably following the Talmud. What's the Talmud? A bunch of rabbinic traditions that they made up when they decided they have to come up with a new religious system to replace the one that needed the temple. Once they didn't have a temple and sacrifices, which is what Judaism in the Bible is about, they had to come up with another Judaism, a man-made Judaism that doesn't need the things that God required. And these were the traditions of the elders that Jesus said to the Pharisees, full well you reject the word of God to keep your traditions. He called them hypocrites because they rejected the word of God. And certainly Orthodox Judaism does not follow Leviticus. You know, does not follow Exodus, does not follow the laws, because they can't. There's no tabernacle, there's no priesthood, there's no sacrifices. And therefore, what they did, I think it was around 135 after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, a bunch of rabbis got together to decide how to put together a form of Judaism that doesn't require the sacrifices. In other words, it doesn't require following the Torah, you know. What they did is they retained, of course, some of the moral stuff and some of the ceremonial things, obviously a kosher diet and keeping the festivals and so forth. But even the keeping of the festivals in the Torah requires going to the temple and offering sacrifices. So, you know, if you're keeping Passover or Pentecost or tabernacles or whatever, and you're not going to a temple in Jerusalem and not offering animal sacrifices, you're not following those festivals the way that Moses said to do it. So, you know, that's just something that, you know, if a Christian says, if your friend says, well, I used to be a Christian, but I don't think Jesus is the Messiah, but I do believe in the Old Testament, well, he can't become an Orthodox Jew on that basis, because the Orthodox Judaism does not follow Torah that Moses came. Part of it, you know, they took the parts they can, but the majority of it, which they can't, they simply learn to get along without. So that would be something to consider, too. Brother, we've talked a long time. I got a lot of callers. You okay?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. Let's talk to Earl from Roseville, California. Hi, Earl.
Yeah, hello, Steve. Yes, I was listening to your program a while ago, and you made a statement. You said, they get to be the stars of the show. I didn't hear the context of your statement, but I think you were referring to how the modern-day Christian church is set up, that it's not the right setup compared to the way the early church was organized after Christ left the apostles. Can you explain this?
I don't know what you're referring to when I said they used to be the stars there. Who used to be?
Oh, you said they used to be the stars of the show. So I assume you were referring to pastors who head the modern day Christian church. And I didn't hear the context of your statement. I was assuming you were referring to the way the modern day church is set up. It's not the right way.
I don't remember the conversation or to whom I was referring. If I was referring to any pastors, I might be, because some pastors simply are showmen, but not all pastors are that way. So, I mean, I do believe churches are set up differently now than they were when the apostles were here. For example, we don't have any example in the New Testament of a church that had a pastor. Had elders. Oh, yeah, so they had elderships, and so having a pastor is a custom that developed after the time of the apostles, and it was not the way they set the churches up. But again, I don't say that to condemn pastors, and I certainly wouldn't say that every pastor is addicted to being the star of the show. I might have been talking about Diotrephes when we were talking about 3 John. Diotrephes kind of liked to be the big boss in the church. He liked to have the preeminence. There are pastors like that. I certainly have met some. Thankfully, most of the pastors I know are not quite that gauche. But I do think that I do think you'll find that sometimes.
Oh, okay. What do you think of mega churches? You know, where they have members that you know amount to like 3,000 to 5,000 and higher, and how they operate.
Yeah, I don't think you can condemn a church for having a lot of people. I will say that a church with that many people is not one that I'm particularly interested in being in, because I like to have relationships with people. And usually, and I'm not trying to brush with too broad a brush, but I mean, just an observation. I've been in churches for 50 years or more. Usually, if you have a church that's got 3,000 to 10,000 or 15,000 people, you've got several services on Sunday morning just to accommodate them. And that means the pastor barely knows anyone in the church. I mean, he knows as many people as perhaps is reasonable for him to, as a man who can only have so many friends. But and similarly, in some of the large groups like that, they simply have to manage the church, sort of like if there was a concert schedule and you had to get one crowd in there efficiently and then move them out as efficiently as possible for the next crowd to come in or something like that. I mean, it gets to be very much like a business or an entertainment thing, shuffling crowds around rather than building relationships and making disciples between people. So I'm not saying that there aren't good pastors who are trying to work with that handicap of the handicap of having a huge congregation. But I would say I myself always look for a smaller group because I like to have relationships with people. I'd like to know the pastor. I'd like to know the elders. I'd like for them to be able to know me. I'd like to know the you know, it's nice to be in a church that if you're there for a year, let's say, you kind of know almost everyone's name. Might be a few people you don't know, but you've been in several of their homes. They've been in your home. You actually have real relationships. They're really a community of Christ, and they're not just a Jesus show on Sunday morning. That'd be my thoughts. Now, again, I don't say that to condemn large churches. A pastor who draws a large crowd, I'm not jealous of him. Believe me, I wouldn't want to be in his place. Not because he's a bad man, but because he's got a big burden. A big burden that, and I don't mean to say just a lot of responsibility to be a good pastor, but he's got a big burden of management of a lot of people and probably a big staff and stuff like that. Things that I would, sounds horrible to me. It's just not the thing I'm attracted to at all. I would like to be with a few people, relatively few, and get to know them really well and be involved in their lives. Like the early Christians, I think, were. So I have different tastes. But some people, it may be that their church is very large and really does a good job of discipling people and preaching the gospel, whatever. I have to say that most of the big churches I've been to, I haven't felt that that's what was going on. But I think a lot of the pastors have tried. And some may be more successful than others in doing so. All right, let's talk to Eddie from New Haven, Connecticut. Eddie, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hey, Steve. How you doing today?
Good.
See, my question is, if we're reading the Torah in Deuteronomy, and we're living, obviously, when Jesus is on the earth, and we read that the Torah says, do not add or take away to any of God's commandments. So now we hear Jesus say, you heard it said, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I tell you, if you just look upon it. So now I go home and tell my Jewish family, hey, guess what the guy said? He said, is that adding? And if someone says that's not adding, it's like, wait a minute, of course it's adding. You added something to the commandment.
No, that's expounding.
How do we get around that?
That's expounding on the commandment. What he's saying is, you've heard, your rabbis told you, excuse me, you've heard, your rabbis have told, okay, it seems like we end up talking at the same time. He's saying your rabbis have told you that you must not commit adultery. What they didn't tell you is that even if you're looking at women to lust after them, that is adultery. Now, he's not making a new commandment. He's telling you that's what the commandment means. It means not only sleeping with your neighbor's wife, it's fantasizing about sleeping with your neighbor's wife. It's desiring to sleep with your neighbor's wife. That too, he said, is adultery in the heart. Now, he's not saying, and this is a, let's make this a new commandment. Jesus is implying this was, you know, true in the commandment from the beginning. It's just not what your rabbis have told you. I mean, in Job, I think it's chapter 31, if I'm not mistaken, maybe verse 1. Job's one of the oldest books before there was even Torah. He said, I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a maid? In other words, he's made an agreement with his eyes not to be looking lustfully at women other than his wife. So, in other words, Jesus didn't make this ethic up as a brand new ethic, but rather, it's Job 31:1. It's an old ethic. It's something that was kind of baked into the commandment, but the rabbis had basically reduced the commandments to a set of outward behaviors where God was really looking on the heart of these matters. That's why Jesus said, you know, it's wrong to murder, but he says it's kind of wrong to be hateful to your brother too and angry at your brother without a cause. Why? Because that's the spirit of anger. It's like I was talking to the other person who called about Judaism, that, you know, it's taking the law simply in an externalistic way and missing the entire spiritual aspects of it. Jesus simply was telling them, these are the parts you haven't been told. So I'm telling you. I mean, the rabbis didn't tell you this, but I will. But he's not saying this is new. He's saying this is stuff that someone should have told you before. And if they won't do it, I'll tell you this. So, yeah, he's not adding new laws. Remember when they asked him what the great commandment was? He said, well, love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as you love yourself. Both of those are in the Torah. And he said, all the law hangs on those two things. And do that, and he says you'll be fine. So that's what I don't think Jesus was adding laws. If anything, there were probably fewer, well, there's certainly fewer laws involved in being a Christian than being, under the Torah. For example, dietary laws and things like that. I think someone could, maybe a Jew would probably complain more about the laws that Jesus didn't require his disciples to keep, which Moses did, rather than laws that Jesus might be said to have added. One more call before we're done. We don't have much time. Mike from Roseburg, Oregon. Hi.
I'm going to make this quick. Jesus came in the clouds and the dead were raised first, and then that we are alive will be raised up with him, and then we'll always be with the Lord. Okay, that's one.
Wait. You just said, wait. Before you go further, you just said, use that in the past tense. You're saying that already happened?
No.
Oh, you said it in the past tense. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't
finish your thought.
I don't think that's happened yet.
Okay, I don't either. Go ahead.
Okay, the second one is that he comes and he comes to the Mount of Olives and it splits. That is the final one after, in my opinion, okay, after the Book of Revelations is fulfilled. I know you think it was fulfilled in Jerusalem. I have wrestled with that one. I just simply don't believe that.
Well, I wish we had more time. I wish we had more time because when you mention the Mount of Olives splitting, the Bible never associates the splitting of the Mount of Olives with the second coming of Jesus. The splitting of the Mount of Olives is mentioned in Zechariah 14:4, a chapter that never mentions Jesus or the second coming of Jesus. It talks about Yahweh standing on that mountain, which he had done before. He had done it in Ezekiel 11:23, which means he left the temple and stood outside Jerusalem, abandoning it to its invaders. In the case of Ezekiel 11:23, it was the Babylonians. In the case of Zechariah 14:4, it's the Romans. But there's no mention of the second coming of Christ in Zechariah 14 that I can see. Hey, I'm out of time. I wish I wasn't. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener supported. You can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, to see how to support us, or just take the free stuff that's abundantly provided there, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.